This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castillo. Sanctions are used by international organizations such as the United Nations and individual countries around the world as an important foreign policy tool. Rather than waging an actual war that can cost many lives, governments may choose to impose sanctions on other nations, organizations, and even specific people in order to protect their own national security interests, enforce international laws, and mitigate threats against global peace and security. In recent weeks, the U.S. has proposed increased sanctions against Russia for reasons that range from concerns over interference in the U.S. elections to the recent attempted assassination with a deadly nerve agent of a former Russian military intelligence officer and his daughter in the U.K. A few months ago, President Donald Trump announced that the U.S. is withdrawing from the landmark 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear deal. That deal included easing some of the sanctions against Iran that had been in place for years. Earlier this month, the president said that the U.S. would also restore those previously lifted sanctions against Iran. Some people claim that sanctions do work, while others say that they are ineffective and could actually backfire on the country that imposes them. Today, we'll find out what sanctions are and discuss the recent use of sanctions by the U.S. Joining me today in the VOA Broadcast Center is John Glazer, Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank. And by telephone from San Francisco is Edward Fishman, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, which is another Washington-based think tank. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And thanks for having me.
Let's get into the basics, if we could. John, tell us, what are sanctions?
Well, sanctions are government policies meant to isolate another government economically, to sort of turn the screws on another government's economy in order to pressure them to change policy in a certain desired direction.
Edward, when you hear of sanctions, most people tend to think of economic measures. I understand there are actually several types of sanctions.
Well, sanctions can be imposed for a lot of different reasons. So there are some sanctions that target specifically counterterrorist financing. There are other sanctions that target nuclear programs or sanctions that target all different types of behavior. But when push comes to shove, John's right, it all comes down to applying economic pressure. So it's cutting off different economic pathways that U.S. adversaries use to either try to obtain weapons of mass destruction or do anything else that the U.S. doesn't want them to do.
Along with economics, are there any other kind of sanctions, John, such as diplomatic, I understand, sports, and even arts?
Well, those things tend not to be used in the way we talk about sanctions as a matter of policy. You know, you can expel diplomats from your country as a form of sanction, as a form of punishment, kind of reaction to something that you don't like from the adversary country. But mainly when we talk about sanctions, we're talking about economic restrictions, withholding purchasing of oil or goods in order to pressure the government to make policy changes.
Edward, how successful are sanctions in accomplishing foreign affairs policies?
Well, you know, that's a complex question, Rick, because, you know, there's a lot that has to go into making a sanctions program effective. I think the record of sanctions, you know, actually has not been particularly good for the United States. And that's because throughout U.S. history, more often than not, America has imposed sanctions largely for political reasons more than policy reasons, and also hasn't taken the diplomatic steps to get support. That said, in the context of recent history, U.S. sanctions against Iran, which started in the Bush administration and culminated really toward the end of the Obama administration and the Iran nuclear deal, were extraordinarily effective. I'd posit as well that President Obama's sanctions against Russia in 2014 to 2015 in the early days of the Ukraine crisis were very effective at deterring Russia from further aggression in Ukraine.
So what Ed started out saying is very accurate. I think if you look at, there is an actual robust academic literature on the effectiveness of sanctions and broad-based studies that try to include dozens and dozens of cases over many decades show that they tend to be successful anywhere from 10 to 30% of the time, which is not a great record. When we sanction countries for security issues rather than economic or trade issues, they tend to be even less successful. So there's a very famous study by University of Chicago's Robert Pape that said these kinds of sanctions efforts are only successful about 5% of the time. But even in the supposed success stories like Iran, there's a lot of nuance. So we had harsh economic sanctions on Iran from 2000 to 2014. And during that time, Iran went from zero centrifuges to 19,000 centrifuges. That kind of muddies the water a bit in terms of how successful sanctions are. The other thing to consider is that there's several factors other than sanctions that if we didn't have, it wouldn't have been terribly effective. So, for example, the Obama administration engaged in good faith negotiations, and they were flexible on what they demanded of Iran. They said, okay, we'll grant you the permission to have a civilian nuclear enrichment program. That was a previously something that they said you can't do. And so there was, it was a negotiation. The election of Hassan Rouhani, for example, if that didn't happen, I'm not sure that sanctions would have been such a success story. Problem is that we're dealing with counterfactuals. So I'm surprised to hear Ed say that sanctions against Russia were successful. That assumes that Russia would have gone further and tried to conquer all of Ukraine in the absence of sanctions, and I don't think that there's reason to believe that. What I think we see with Russia's sanctions is a lot of sanctions that we are imposing in order to nominally get Russia to perhaps forfeit Crimea or stop supporting separatists in Ukraine, and there's just no way that's going to happen because sanctions are a kind of weak tool of coercive diplomacy.
Edward, a response?
I think John hit on one important point, Rick, that I think worth zeroing in on, which is that sanctions in and of themselves are not a policy. Sanctions are just leverage. They're a tool of leverage for the United States to try to coerce a foreign country to do something it otherwise wouldn't want to do. So in the case of Russia, John's right, it's hard to know exactly what Russia's intentions were in Ukraine. But certainly the rhetoric coming out of the Kremlin in 2014 suggested that Russia's ambitions went beyond occupying a very small percentage of Ukrainian territory in the southeastern part of the country. So, again, impossible to assess a counterfactual, but I think that there's good evidence to say that they were effective with respect to Russia. But I think the broader point here is that the reason sanctions today under the Trump administration, unfortunately, have little chance of succeeding is that oftentimes today they're not really embedded in a broader policy. And that's because largely coming out of the heart of American power in the White House, President Trump has been wildly inconsistent in his policies toward Russia, toward North Korea, toward Iran, sort of vacillating rapidly between very tough measures and much more forgiving measures. And so I think it's difficult for anyone now to understand what it would even take for Russia, North Korea, or Iran to do in order for U.S. sanctions to be lifted. And that's because of one person, President Trump, whose inconsistent policies have got us into this mess.
I understand when you're dealing with sanctions, there are two types of basically unilateral sanctions, which is basically one country or one group imposing sanctions. And then you have multilateral sanctions, such as UN-issued sanctions, plus what I'm assuming would have been the result of the Iran nuclear deal. Which of the two, John, do you think are more successful? Is it a unilateral sanction or a multilateral sanction?
It's definitely multilateral. So the problem with unilateral sanctions is that if you don't have the cooperation of the world community, or at least several countries allied with you, the sanctions don't bite. So, for example, with Iran, we don't have that much bilateral trade with Iran. Our sanctions can hurt them. They can discourage foreign investment. They can sort of pressure foreign companies from investing in Iran. But the reason that the pre-JCPOA, the pre-Iran nuclear deal sanctions under the Obama administration on Iran were seen to be very successful was because he had the world behind him. He asked the Northeast Asian allies and Europe to make serious economic sacrifices in pressuring Iran economically, and that kind of community and multilateral effort is really what made the sanctions bite in a severe way.
Edward, I understand there are some folks saying that imposing sanctions on Iran at this point, especially with the majority of the signatories of the Iran deal, really kind of surprised by the U.S. dropping out of the deal and the president reimposing the sanctions again. Do you think, as John mentioned, that the sanctions are going to have less bite because of the concerns of the other signatories of the agreement?
Without question, any new sanctions that the Trump administration imposes on Iran are going to have significantly less bite than they did back before 2013 and before 2015 when we got the final Iran nuclear deal. And that's because, John mentioned, having support not only from Europe but also from Asia was extremely significant. I'll give you one example. Before the U.S. started basically working with foreign countries to cut Iran's oil exports in 2012, Iran exported 2.5 million barrels of oil a day. Within 18 months, with the cooperation of the European Union, even China and India and Turkey, those exports were cut from 2.5 million barrels a day to only about a million barrels a day. Now, you know, Iran's oil exports are back up to over 2 million barrels a day. And I think the Trump administration is going to have a lot of difficulty persuading Beijing, New Delhi, Ankara to really start cutting into Iran's oil imports, exports.
After the president announced renewed sanctions against Iran, that China has made it a concerted effort to make sure that it gets all its oil supply from Iran.
Well, yeah, they're making a concerted effort to continue economic projects in Iran and continue to receive oil imports from Iran, certainly. China relies more on Persian Gulf oil for its energy supply than we do. And the kind of sanctions that we're trying to impose now unilaterally on Iran, China's kind of insulated from those, especially compared to our European allies. So one of the things that our European allies are trying to do is set up what's called blocking regulations. These are efforts to protect European companies trying to do business in Iran legally for them, but which are apt to face punishment and harsh sanctions from the United States imposing secondary sanctions on them. So just to kind of put a bow on this, sanctions are not all that effective to begin with, but especially when you don't have the support of allies, when they're not multilateral, and when they're only unilateral and other countries are literally trying to push back against our sanctions effort, they're certainly not going to be effective and have enough of a bite. But secondly, to pick up something that Ed said earlier, when the sanctioning country, in this case the United States, doesn't tell the target state precisely what actions it can take in order to get sanctions lifted, there's no chance for sanctions to be effective in changing policy because it's not even clear what policy Iran could adopt besides full capitulation and forfeiting of their entire sovereignty in order to get sanctions lifted. So this is a problem. It's just not going to work. It's a broken strategy.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Here's a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/encounter, or from iTunes. And here's a happy birthday shout out to Anobo Charles Anope in Nigeria. We hope you, too, will get in touch with us either through Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or by sending us an old-fashioned email to encounter@voanews.com. And now back to our program. Today, we're talking about the use of sanctions by the United States. My guests are John Glazer, Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and Edward Fishman, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Both are Washington, D.C.-based think tanks. Edward, before we went to break, we were talking about President Trump's decision to reinstate sanctions against Iran and the need for support by U.S. allies. The president later warned that countries doing business with Iran will not be doing business with the United States. What are your thoughts on this?
So the U.S. does have quite a bit of leverage over, you know, transactions that occur with Iran that don't even involve U.S. companies. So, for example, the U.S. has a lot of leverage over European oil companies or even Chinese banks and oil companies that may be involved in transactions with Iran. And so, theoretically, the Trump administration could threaten sanctions against these European and Chinese companies if they do business with Iran. The problem with that, though, Rick, is that the threat isn't particularly credible. I mean, the idea of the U.S. imposing sanctions on Total, for example, a very large French oil company, to me seems to be not a particularly credible threat. So, sure, if the Trump administration wants to unilaterally wage economic war against Europe, China, India, Turkey all at once, sure, he can do that. I think that the problem will be that, you know, the U.S. is going to wind up isolating itself. And in reality, those countries will still continue doing business with Iran after they're shut out from the United States.
John, do you see the sanctions imposed by the U.S. backfiring?
Well, I see the entire strategy backfiring. You know, we successfully negotiated under the Obama administration one of the most robust non-proliferation agreements in history. It was called by the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency as the most robust and intrusive inspections regime in the world. Iran gave up 98% of its enriched uranium. They agreed to several restrictions, some of which expire 10, 15, 20, 25 years down the line, but some of which, the most important of which, are permanent and never end. And the Trump administration forfeited that success for reasons that are not based on the substance of the agreement itself. It seems to be based on his antipathy for the success of his predecessor in this case. So, yes, the sanctions will fail. The pressure campaign is going to fail. And part of that is because the Trump administration is insisting that Iran essentially change its regime in order to get relief from this kind of pressure. One of the things that worries me is that President Trump is kind of a machine for confirmation bias. So, for example, he believes, and he has said multiple times, that the maximum pressure policy towards North Korea is what brought them to the table and had them offer to meet Trump face-to-face and what eventually led to the Trump-Kim summit in June. But that's actually not what occurred. North Korea offered to meet and negotiate for a couple of reasons. First of all, they had achieved, to their satisfaction, a viable nuclear deterrent, which gave them leverage at the negotiating table. They could talk with the United States on a more equal basis. And secondly, the extraordinary efforts of South Korean President Moon Jae-in, who took the exact opposite approach of Trump. He didn't hurl threats of nuclear holocaust across social media or insist on ever-tightening sanctions. He campaigned and acted in a way that was about conciliation, sunshine policy, concessions, compromise, negotiation, etc. And these factors had much more to do with North Korea's willingness to come to the table than the Trump's maximum pressure policy. And even now, the kind of bias towards hardline bullying that the Trump administration has is probably undermining what could have been a good start to a long process of negotiations with North Korea after the summit. The Trump administration, I think, is just on the wrong track in terms of foreign policy towards these adversary states.
Your thoughts, Edward?
I'm not going to pretend to know what's inside President Trump's head and why he was so eager to meet with Kim Jong-un. I mean, I can speculate it had something to do with domestic politics in the United States and trying to achieve some sort of headline in the United States. But what I would say is that I don't see it as an accomplishment that President Trump met with a dictator that no U.S. president had been willing to meet with in the past. You know, the meeting that happened in Singapore back in June was a unilateral concession, essentially, to North Korea. You know, by giving Kim Jong-un sort of the legitimacy and sort of that photo op with the U.S. president, I think basically the number one thing Trump accomplished was to weaken international resolve to isolate North Korea. So what have you seen since that summit? You've seen on the North Korean side absolutely zero progress in denuclearization and no indication whatsoever that North Korea is interested in getting rid of its nuclear program. But then around the world, you see basically the end of North Korea's isolation. You see reports that Xi Jinping may be visiting North Korea next month. Clearly, there's much more trade going on now between China and North Korea, between Russia and North Korea, to the extent that the U.S. Treasury Department is trying to impose sanctions on Chinese and Russian companies. So all Trump really accomplished by his Singapore summit was to end North Korea's isolation and undermine the sanctions and the quote-unquote maximum pressure strategy that he had been trying to put in place.
We've talked about Iran. We've talked briefly about North Korea. Let's talk about Russia. And it seems like he almost needs a scorecard to keep track of what sanctions are going on. John, what sanctions are in place and what are being proposed right now? Let's see if we can get up to date on that.
Well, there are a number of sanctions targeted towards Russia's oil sector, also towards the kind of high-level officials, targeted sanctions against individuals and particular companies that might put the screws on the Russian elite in Moscow, etc., and Putin's sort of advisors and so on. Look, U.S.-Russian relations have been souring for some time. That is a result of both U.S. actions and Russian actions. There's a lot that we made mistakes on, excessive commitment, almost of a religious nature about NATO expansion, gobbling up former Soviet republics and even approaching the Russian border in some cases, trying to pull Ukraine and Georgia into the Western orbit. This really rattled Moscow's cages. George W. Bush's administration's abandonment of ballistic missile treaties and so on. All of these things soured Russian relations. And now, especially after the 2016 election meddling, what you have in this country is a kind of excessive hysteria about Russia, and we're inflating the threat that Russia actually poses to U.S. interests. Even though their meddling in the 2016 election was terrible and something should be done about it, there's a tendency these days to pretend like Russia's 10 feet tall, as opposed to a sort of declining power, lots of demographic problems, lots of weaknesses in terms of its projection of power and so on. And that can lead to a situation in which we look away from areas of cooperation or compromise and insist on a really hardline, tough policy that probably won't bring us much. It's not going to bring us much to excessively sanction Moscow. They're not going to capitulate and say, okay, we're sorry, we'll become this docile power now and conform to your demands. Instead, we need to respect Russia as a power in its own sphere and take a more flexible and balanced approach. And that's the only way we're going to get away from this kind of reflexive hostility that doesn't lead to some kind of strategic end.
Edward, let's hear from you, your concerns and your thoughts regarding sanctions on Russia.
Well, I would disagree with a lot of what John said. What Russia has done in the last several years has been effectively to undermine U.S. interests all around the globe, starting with Ukraine, invading the country, annexing territory in Europe for the first time since the Second World War, really undermining the very heart of the liberal order in Europe. Moving on to Russia's actions in Syria and also in the interference in the 2016 U.S. election and continued interference in American democracy, I think it's very important for the U.S. to push back against this. The place where I would agree with John, however, is that capitulation isn't a reasonable expectation from Moscow. Russia's not going to throw out the white flag and say, okay, you know, all of a sudden we're just going to cave to all of American demands. That's why I do think it's important for the U.S. to build up as much economic leverage as possible so that we can sort of pick and choose the areas where we do get progress from Russia and changing behavior. The problem we have now, though, is that you have the vast majority of the American political system, Democrats, Republicans in Congress, and even President Trump's own cabinet that believes that Russia needs to be pressured. But then you have a president who seems himself willing to capitulate to Russia and effectively not thinking that any pressure is needed on the Kremlin right now. And so I think it's very difficult to foresee any of the current sanctions changing Moscow's policies, because if you think about it from the perspective of Putin, why leave Ukraine when President Trump doesn't seem to think it's an issue that you're in Ukraine? You know, why stop interfering in American elections when the President of the United States doesn't think that's an issue? But I think that, unfortunately, the state of U.S. policy right now is one in which leverage is going to continue to build up pretty slowly on Russia through a combination of sanctions, but also congressional action. And we'll have to wait for another occupant of the White House to try to make good on that leverage and actually translate it into beneficial policy outcomes vis-a-vis Russia.
Look, there's just no way that Russia is going to back out of Ukraine or give back Crimea as a result of U.S. pressure. It's hard for me to even see how what's going on in Ukraine impacts U.S. interests at all. It said that it was a threat to U.S. interests, what's happened in Ukraine. How? To put it in the context of the sort of liberal world order that we supposedly have led for 70 years, the United States has violated the liberal world order at least as often as Russia has. We've invaded Iraq in a clear violation of the laws of war as a war crime. We engaged in military action in the Balkans to help a secessionist country of Kosovo, despite the fact that we lacked a UN Security Council resolution. In fact, if you go back to the Clinton administration, we involved ourselves very heavily in the 1996 election of Yeltsin in Russia, and we secured an IMF loan on his behalf and did all these kinds of backdoor, behind-the-scenes politicking in his favor, and he ended up winning. That is seen in Russia as equally problematic as the 2016 meddling is seen in this country. So, look, the problem with U.S. foreign policy for a long time has been that we view every nook and cranny of planet Earth to be of vital U.S. interests. We are an extremely safe country, largely insulated from external threats. We're the most powerful country in the world. We're one of the richest countries in the world. We need to understand that and stop trying to meddle and stick our noses in distant regions for peripheral interests when we know that they're not going to yield the results that we want. Russia's not going to back out of Georgia, Ukraine. It's not going to stop insisting on its sort of sphere of influence in Eastern Europe and so on.
Gentlemen, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. My guests have been John Glazer, Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and Edward Fishman, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Both are Washington, D.C.-based think tanks. Thanks to both of you for joining me today.
Thank you. you.
Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Rebecca Ward for her help with today's program, as well as our studio technician, Joe Gill. And thanks to you for taking time to listen today. Encounter was produced at the VOA Studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join Carol Castiel again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.